accession number 14282, real 8.
Mr. Hooker, reel 8.
And that made up the four tables. Another feature, which to the landsmen may not seem very important, was they had a source of iced drinking water. It was like a communal, little small communal fountain outside the saloon where you could get a drink of ice water at any time. Now that was a big boon when you were down in the tropics, because previous experience had shown that by about noontime on a ship down there, the drinking water was warm, and at times it could have been hot. So that was a great thing, just to have the ice drinking water, because as time would tell, we would be going down on the equator again before the end of the trip. The main bulkhead, Thorpe ships, didn't have a portrait of Sir John, or the equivalent of a Sir John. It was a number of portraits of film stars that had attended the launching of the vessel in Savannah, Georgia, what must have been the early part of 1944. And it was certainly more pleasing to look at than pictures of Sir John. A crew had been flown across to Savannah, a British crew flown over to Savannah to bring her back. That must have been possibly just prior to me joining her in Birkenhead. The skipper, Captain Laidlaw, was doing his first trip as skipper, it turned out, and he proved to be not only a very competent seaman for his first trip as skipper, but he was like the other deck officers. They were very tolerant sort of people. There was no nonsense, but they were very tolerant people, and they wanted to, he wanted to have his ship, and he had a crew. Like in the catering department, for instance, the catering department can sometimes affect if a ship is happy or not. And of course, the main thing is it was the shipping company with whom I was sailing with. It was a prestigious company. It shipped the Athenia, was a first passenger ship sunk during the war, the Athenia. That was one of their ships. The Letitia was another sister ship of the Athenia. And they had a regular peacetime cargo run on the west coast of America, apart from sailing to Canada. And they also had another regular run down to South America with refrigerated ships. A lot of their ships were named after the South American rivers. These are things I learned, you know, when I'd been on board for a while, on board the ship for a while. The chief officer, it was because of the insular life we led on board, you could not afford really to be too well. You didn't pay to show too much of your personal self. You know what I mean? You didn't reckon to give too much away, because it was rather an extraordinary thing. It was the first ship that I'd been on, the Sam Finn, and I'd sailed on six or seven before that, where occasionally you called it like among your own. I'm not talking about the skipper and the mate and that, but among your own, like the cadets and the other ROs, you exchange Christian names. Now on other ships, you always called, if you were the fourth engineer, they'd call him fourth, or the third mate, they call him third. They never mentioned surnames, and very rare I ever heard a Christian name mentioned. Whether they felt they couldn't go as far as that for to be too familiar, I don't know. Because it's a ship, if you cross swords with anybody, as you've probably heard before, you had to live with that until the vessel paid off, you know. You had nowhere to run. You couldn't go down the local pub or anything like that. You had nowhere to run. But the Sam Finn turned out to be a ship where we did, among just like the juniors, I was one of the juniors, we did exchange Christian names. And so that was something else that was nice about the vessel. So she carried the usual dozen naval ratings to man the gun points. Of course, there wasn't enough. The equivalent number of maritime gunners put aboard that. If the Americans had crewed that vessel, there would have been 26 gunners. But the British made do with 12 and then called upon the Merchant Navy crew to man the other guns, the Horlickans. So almost as soon as I went on board, the second officer, who was always the gunnery officer, asked me if I'd like to take charge of one of the Horlickans, in an emergency, you see, which I, having done a 3-day gunnery course in Freetown, I agreed, you know. It was all a question. It was an unpaid thing, but it was all way of life. It was the ship was your home. You were only going to defend your home, you know. So that was what it turned out to be. There was one of the cadets, Arnold Manson from Orkney, and myself. We were on one particular gun. And I remember Jimmy, the second steward, and Bobby, the third steward, was on one of the other ones. And then the rest of the seven would have been distributed between other members of the crew. So that was... I've told you a little bit about the ship. The chief officer, the Englishman, a guy in his 40s, he was very quiet. And he was one... Eventually, as the trip went on, people started letting out things, you know. They become a bit more familiar as time went on. But that was one guy that never changed his composure. I hardly ever heard him speak, and he remained like that right up until the ship paid off a year later. So when I joined her at Birkenhead, the third Sparks and I, we were going to sail the next day. We went ashore that night and had a few drinks in the pubs, and then when we had a bit too much to drink, and must have, and I suppose about 1 o'clock in the morning, we didn't know if we were going to get the ferry. This is ashore in Liverpool, you see, if we were going to get back to Birkenhead. So we stumbled into a Salvation Army place where there were ladies preparing sandwiches and steaming hot cups of tea, and even though they knew we'd had a little bit too much to drink, you know, they made us very welcome. And I've always remembered the Salvation Army since, and will always put a coin or two in their boxes, even if only just for that one night. So, and I met the Chief Sparks, Reese Hurd from Paisley, another Scot, and he turned out to be a hell of a nice guy. You were expected to do your job, of course, but he turned out to be a hell of a nice guy. I can't remember one guy that, you know, they say there's always one, like there's always a bad apple in the barrel, but I can't remember one that wasn't sociable. And that was over a period of a year. So the last, I remember the cadets supervising the hatch covers when the vessel had finished loading, and the last thing to go on was sacks of mail. Last on, you see, first off. So the old procedure, we sailed from Liverpool via the North Channel, headed out into the Atlantic, so far west. You always done a dog leg, you see, to avoid the U-boat bases and the Luftwaffe bases in Brittany, down the Atlantic coast. You dog leg out. I've known once when we went to 33 West, halfway across to America, to come strike back towards Europe or the continent of Africa. Did the usual dogleg. It was on about, it was what now, summer of 1944. We hadn't sailed for the beaches of Normandy, you know, not to continue the support there for the invasion. And we headed down towards the Med and again through the Straits. Sailed up the Med, unmolested. The only problem was we saw these loose mines floating about that had broken adrift, and one wondered, you know, you could, at night you could strike one, you wouldn't see them then. I used to have a bit of gunnery practice. We did have an exercise coming down to Jib, whereby we had a direction finding receiver, you see, and the Bellini Atosi aerial coupled with it, and we used to keep listening watches on 600 meters distress frequency, the wireless telegraphy distress frequency, and we were to listen out for series of V's, groups of three V's. And if we heard any, we were to DF them, find out, you know, get a bearing on them and report it to the captain. And U-boats would transmit these series of Vs to call up other U-boats to form a wolf pack. And that was the way they did it. They would transmit these V signals, you see, if they spotted a convoy and they wanted more U-boats to congregate. And that was why we had to listen out for these, we had to monitor for these groups of V's. As it turned out, we never heard any. We sailed up the Med. I remember it was very, the weather was very nice for the Med, because the Med isn't always a isn't always sun and blue skies. So we had a mixed cargo. We had a deck cargo of motor transport and a mixed war cargo. Well, obviously we were for a war front. By this time Sicily had been invaded by the British and American forces, and they were off into Italy, because that was where the Argyle had gone, you see, Brindisi. But they'd taken Naples, and I think they were just about ready. They were going to take Rome by the time we got out there again. And we sailed to Naples via Port Augusta, called in there, through the Straits of Sorrento. I remember seeing the volcanic islands, Stromboli smoking. She was, you wouldn't erupt him, but she was smoking. Well, when we got into the Bay of Naples, well, in about June, July, it was absolutely chock-a-block full of shipping, much as the sea was in Freetown in 42, 43. There were hospital ships at anchor, there were warships, destroyers, loads of merchantmen, and the obviously it was the backup and support for the fighting in Italy. Well, we lay outside the breakwater, as it turned out, for 2 weeks. Just after the day after we arrived, an LST, a landing ship tank, came alongside with red caps on board, and they took off the sacks of mail, and then they took other cargo. They discharged other cargo into this LST, and it turned out to be paper money. We'd brought out a cargo, a special compartment had been built in the tween decks for British military authority currency. See, with the inflation ashore in Italy during the war, which, and the same in Tripoli, I think, and other places, the British had printed new paper money, and it was called the British military authority money. It had it stamped on it, just like an ordinary banknote. And in this case, it was lira, you see. It was the denominations were in lira. So they loaded. There must have been millions of lira that we brought out in this in the twin decks. So that was taken off. And then for a fortnight, nobody came near us. And obviously, we would have been waiting our turn to go alongside, you see. Because it turned out that the RAF had bombed the dock installations in Naples when the Germans were there, and plus the Germans had placed demolition charges everywhere in Naples, the big public buildings, the docks, the dockside facilities were almost non-existent, you see, which made it harder for ships to discharge there. And we lads, the three cadets and the two ROs and the fourth engineer, we used to go down a rope ladder every afternoon swimming off the ship, you know, just deep water. It must have been maybe 15, 20 fathoms. And we used to have a great time. That was a ritual we had every afternoon, used to break up the monotony. And on some ships, the skipper or the chief officer would have frowned upon it, you see, but not on this ship. Then we'd come in and we'd have a shower. Oh, by the way, another important thing on the Sam Finn was she had half a dozen showers in a block. And the rest of the crew had them as well. It wasn't just the officers. And all the other ships used to have an old enamel bath, as I previously mentioned. But it would have been so much better if they, particularly on the Canadian fort boats, if they'd put showers, because one wouldn't have used the quantity of water to start with, you see. I mean, you fill up a bath, well. So we used to have our swim and every afternoon and then a shower after. One had to be careful when along the waterline and just below it, there were barnacles that formed, you see. They were very, very sharp, like razors. One could easily cut their feet if you put your feet on the hull, you see. You know, like to stave yourself off or anything like that. So you had to be very, pretty careful about that. So in a fortnight, about 2 weeks, we went alongside, and we went alongside. We didn't go alongside a dock, because we went alongside and unloaded on the hull of a ship that had capsized. She'd gone over, like her bow was facing in towards the shore, you see. She turned over, and they were using the hull to discharge the cargo on. The lorries were coming on board from the quay onto the hull of the ship, and the derricks on our ship was loading the stuff onto the lorries, you see. And one might have wondered how, you know, she'd got an air raid, I suppose, or something. There might have even been bodies down there still in the ship. One of the features about the Sam Finn was she had, unlike on other ships I'd been on, she had heavy lifting derricks, which meant she could load cargo and discharge it without any shoreside cranes or facilities, you see. Now, because she had these heavy lifting derricks, and she was destined to visit these various ports in the Med that had been subjected to warfare, it was the reason, obviously the reason she was kept in the Med for a year, you see, because we went all over the Mediterranean pretty well in the course of the ensuing year. So that was the first time we would have been using the heavy lifting derricks, you see. So we discharged the cargo, and on the first trip, I don't remember too much about Naples, because in about a week we were I got a little map, an army map of the main street, the Via Roma in Naples at that time, and it did show where various clubs had been set up, for the RAF, the Royal Navy and the Army and all that sort of thing, hostels and all that sort of thing. And there was the no-go area, out-of-bounds area, of course, marked with a big, broad red line. That was because guys were going up these side streets, well, the equivalent of a Casbah then in North Africa, and they were getting, to find these small bars for drink. They were getting knifed, murdered, and all that sort of thing. So that was no-go area. Within about a week, we then sailed for Alexandria, light ship. And within the next year, we would be visiting Naples quite a lot. It became a home port for us. So we went to Alex.
What were conditions like for the civilian population in Naples at that time?
Well, on subsequent visits, they were very bad, I would say. People in history I've read that they were starving. And the Mafia had done a deal with the Americans and the American and British military authorities, I read in post-war history, had done a deal with them because they needed the Mafia as more or less a buffer. See, the Italians had capitulated in southern Italy, well, all over Italy, I suppose, but with the Germans sort of, well, halfway up Italy. The Germans were about halfway up Italy, if you like, or the British American forces, if you like, were halfway up Italy in the course as the battle was proceeding. But the Italians had capitulated, and those in the British and American part of Italy were, well, I suppose the British and Americans wanted a full cooperation of the civilian population. They didn't want resistance or anything. So they must have used the Mafia, you see, and they did a deal with the Mafia, and it was said that for every three ships that sailed to Italy, the contents of one was allocated to the Mafia. There are some very good books on it, actually. But, yeah, there were these young Italian kids in the streets, I remember, going, well, offering their sisters as I never strayed off the Via Roma, you didn't really get into the population. There was no, it was a lot of servicemen mostly in the streets. The only vehicles were jeeps and army lorries. You'd sometimes see American nurses off the hospital ships in the harbour. They were ashore doing some shopping or something like that. On subsequent visits, there was no merchant navy club, but the services always made us very welcome wherever we went out there. Unlike home here, where up until 1944, merchant personnel were not allowed to use NAFI facilities ashore. And it took an Admiralty, or questions in the House of Commons, and an Admiralty order in 1944 to sanction to make NAFI available to the merchant navy. And the war had been on, what, 4 years at least, four and a half years. Well, I found out in the services, I come in contact with the army and the navy and the air force, and they made us, it was a total different scene. We were made welcome everywhere we went. In Alex and Jib, we could use the fleet clubs. I visited several RAF stations, and we always made welcome everywhere we went. I've used army officers' clubs, like in Taranto, and we subsequently played army teams. We got up a scratch football team on the Samfin, and we were invited to play army teams ashore, and have a sing-song and drinks in their mess after, the sergeant's mess. We were just treated like one of them. But Naples, the army had taken over the Royal Palace. They had administrative offices there. It was the office of the Provost Marshal. And if you wanted to, you could go there for take advantage of certain facilities. As much you could go out to, they arranged trips. You had to go in the back of a lorry, but they arranged sanctioned trips out to Pompeii and Herculaneum, places like that. So, Freddie Bergen, the third officer, we were very good pals. We'd done the trip out to Pompeii. And another thing that was free to the Merchant Navy, well, the services which included the Merchant Navy, was the operas at the San Carlo Opera House, down by the right at the port end, the sea end of the Via Roma, well, where the San Carlo Opera House was. It was all there, round together. So, now Alexandria, we didn't go visit there as much as Naples, but we got to know Alex fairly well. On occasions, we would load cargoes of wartime material, take up to Italy, up to Naples. On one occasion, we sailed lightship, as it turned out, for Tripoli, and a deck cargo of barges. The barges we offloaded in Tobruk. There was just about enough room to get into Tobruk. It wasn't a big port or nothing like that. A hell of a lot of merchant ships had been sunk in Tobruk and around and just outside of Tobruk. It must have been to do with the siege there, you know. And they dragged one or two aside so you could just about getting through, you see. And then we offloaded the barges in Tobruk and sailed to Tripoli. Now, Tripoli was another port that had been sort of devastated. By this time, of course, the 8th Army had taken Tobruk and was heading towards... No, they'd already gone up to Tunisia and taken that, right, and gone across to Italy. But the dock installations were in a mess. The surrounding warehouse buildings and all that were all blown to pieces, tattered, floors on different buildings were sort of sagging and hanging out. Well, they're just like a typical war scene. And they'd had the same thing there where the Germans had actually put block ships in the entrance, which wasn't very big to Tripoli, but they had been dragged aside to enable ships like Samfin to go in. And we were, as it actually happened, we were the only merchant ship there. There was no Royal Navy ships. It was just the Samfin. Oh, and lay alongside the outer harbour was a huge passenger ship tied up alongside, which was completely gutted. It had obviously caught fire and was completely gutted. Like up the Gambia River, when we could obviously see the cargo we'd come for before we'd even set a foot ashore, there was our cargo waiting for us in Tripoli, and it was on a huge expanse of the docks. There were all these little neat piles of scrap, old aeroplanes, guns, all the refuse that had been picked up from the Desert War, and it was all in neat piles all over the dockside. So in actual fact, we loaded... I'm going to have to go to the toilet. We loaded a cargo of scrap, you see.